Today we'll complete our study of the book of Joel, which we began 4 weeks ago. And at that time, we noted that the book of Joel divides itself into two almost equal sections. The first section, which we examined last month, is from chapter 1, verse 2 through chapter 2, verse 17. And we characterized this portion of Joel's writing as the bad news, as Brother Sebastian mentioned. Joel described a great calamity which had befallen the land and the people of Israel. And then Joel tells the people what they should do in response. The second major part of the book, which we'll cover today, is from chapter 2, verse 18 to the end of the book. And we could characterize this portion of Joel's writing as the good news. Joel here speaks of Jehovah's blessings and comfort to the people, the destruction of their oppressors, the healing of their land, and peace and safety of the nation after their enemies are no more. But before we begin part two, let's review some of the main points we discussed in part one. Joel most likely lived and prophesied around 850 BC. In chapter one is the description of a literal calamity that came upon the literal nation of Israel. Hordes of insects that swarmed over the land, devouring all the crops and vegetation, leaving nothing behind as food for the people or for their flocks and herds. The most accepted understanding of these insects is that they are the four successive stages of development of an insect called the desert locust. Joel then describes the devastating effect of this calamity on three classes of Israelites: the drunkards, the priests, and the farmers, called husbandmen and vine dressers by Joel. And then Joel says, "This plague of locusts is God's punishment upon us for not obeying his laws. We have been too worldly and not holy enough. Therefore, let us sanctify ourselves, rededicate ourselves to God with a solemn assembly of our leaders and all the people in worship and prayer, or else God will punish us even more with the destruction of our very nation." In part one, we suggested an application of Joel's writings to four time frames. First, in 850 BC, a literal swarm of locusts devastated the literal land of Israel, its economy, and its people. Second, in 606 BC and onward, a symbolic swarm of locusts, the armies of literal Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar, swarmed across the land of literal Israel, taking the people captive and subjugating the Jewish nation until the times of the Gentiles would be fulfilled. We noted a similarity between the prophet Daniel's depiction of the four Gentile empires in the image of gold, silver, brass, and iron, and I suggested that Joel's locusts pictured the first empire in Daniel's image, the head of gold, literal Babylon. Our third time frame application of Joel chapter 1 was of symbolic Babylon during the Dark Ages, when Satan and his masterpiece, the papal system, created a famine in the land for truth and all knowledge, both religious and scientific. Then we considered the remaining bad news of the first part of Joel's prophecy, Joel 2:1-14, which has two main features. The first main feature of Joel chapter 2 is the time setting, our fourth time frame, when the day of the Lord is nigh at hand. That word nigh means it is here. It's not still coming. It has arrived. The day of the Lord has begun, which gives us the time setting of these verses, namely, at the time of the return of our Lord in 1874 and onward. The second main feature of Joel chapter 2, in addition to its time setting, is its graphic and detailed depiction of the Lord's great army, which sweeps across the earth, bringing great fear upon the people and destruction upon the nations. A fitting description of the final stages of the destruction of this present evil world in the harvest of the gospel age. Regarding the makeup of this great army, the Lord's great army, we quoted from volume 4, page 550, where Brother Russell says, "The Lord, by his overruling providence, will take a general charge of this great army of discontents, patriots, reformers, socialists, moralists, anarchists, ignorants, and hopeless, and use their hopes, fears, follies, and selfishness, according to his divine wisdom, to work out his own grand purposes in the overthrow of present institutions, and for the preparation of man for the kingdom of righteousness. For this reason only, it is termed the Lord's great army. None of the saints, none who are led by the Spirit of God as sons of God, are to have anything to do with that part of the battle." And then in closing, we noted that the Lord's great army has heard his voice uttered and is already on the march in increasing numbers. So that's where we ended our discussion of the first part of the book of Joel. But before we get to part two, I have an item I call full disclosure, which came about when someone asked me where I got the idea to write two discourses about the book of Joel. I had to admit that the talk I gave last month and the talk that I'm giving today are actually reruns of discourses I gave for the first time in 1994, followed by part two in 1996. And as I look around the room today, I see three or four of you who might have been here when I gave those two discourses more than 25 years ago. I'm sure you remember them vividly. Someone said I have my notes in case you couldn't hear that. Now, that was before PowerPoint, before the internet, and even before Microsoft Word. I did own a computer in 1994, and it came with two floppy drives, plus a huge 20 megabit hard drive, and a rudimentary word processor, which I used to type my notes back then. However, documents created using that ancient word processor are incompatible with Microsoft Word, so I had to do some juggling to be able to read my notes from back then to prepare for the discourses I gave last month and today. Now, why am I telling you all this? Well, my reason for telling you all this is that at that time, in the mid-1990s, there was no easy access to other discourses on Joel, if they even existed, that I could listen to and research to prepare my talks on the subject. This was the medium used to archive audio files of discourses, and this was the device you used to download them. I essentially had only Brother Russell's writings in hard copy book form, and he wrote very little on the book of Joel. But we also have our knowledge of present truth and the divine plan of the ages to guide us in fitting any scripture we look at into harmony with that revealed truth. Now, by contrast, one of our restitution blessings today is easy access to a vast library of brethren's understanding of the scriptures. So after my talk last month, and here's the point I'm getting to, I received comments from brethren who told me that they had listened to several talks on Joel by other speakers, which I wasn't aware had existed back then, which are now readily available, and they told me that my explanation of the book of Joel was sadly lacking in comparison to those other discourses. And that's fair. In fact, I'll share with you one of those other interpretations suggested to me after my first discourse a month ago that I thought was excellent. You'll recall I suggested that the literal locust symbolized the Babylonian Empire, and then the Babylonian Empire symbolized the nominal church systems and their oppression of the true church during the 1260 years of the Dark Ages. In the alternate suggestion which I received, the literal locust symbolized not just Babylon, but all four of the Gentile empires during the Gentile times, the entire 2,520 years of dominion over natural Israel, not just that shorter time of the Dark Ages that I suggested. And that interpretation explains many of the details differently, but very well, and is worthy of consideration. Okay, all that having been said by way of review, let's now take up our examination of the second section of the book of Joel, the good news in Joel. And we'll start by reading Joel 2, 18 to 27. Then will the Lord be jealous for his land and pity his people. Yea, the Lord will answer and say unto his people, Behold, I will send you corn and wine and oil, and ye shall be satisfied therewith, and I will no more make you a reproach among the heathen. But I will remove far off from you the northern army, and will drive him into a land barren and desolate, with his face toward the east sea, and his hinder part toward the utmost sea. And his stink shall come up, and his ill savor shall come up, because he hath done great things. Fear not, O land, be glad and rejoice, for the Lord will do great things. Be not afraid, ye beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness do spring, for the tree beareth her fruit, the fig tree and the vine do yield their strength. Be glad then, ye children of Zion, and rejoice in the Lord your God, for he hath given you the former rain moderately, and he will cause to come down for you the rain, the former rain, and the latter rain in the first month. And the floors shall be full of wheat, and the fats or vats shall overflow with wine and oil. And I will restore to you the years that the locust hath eaten, the cankerworm and the caterpillar and the palmer worm, my great army which I sent among you. And ye shall eat in plenty, and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God that hath dealt wondrously with you. And my people shall never be ashamed. And ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and none else. And my people shall never be ashamed. In interpreting many of the prophecies about the nation of Israel, we can often see three applications, namely, to literal Israel, the Jewish nation, to symbolic true Israel, the church class, and to restored mankind in the kingdom. And there is even a fourth that we won't see too much in Joel, but a little bit, and that is to symbolic false Israel, the nominal church systems. We'll see all three of these applications as we proceed, but it's important to remember that the time setting of these verses we just read is in the harvest of the gospel age and onward into the establishment of the kingdom. Our first application of these verses is to natural Israel. In verse 18, the first word then confirms that these passages apply to a later time than the previous verses. And this conclusion is further supported by the rest of verse 18, which declares that the Lord will be jealous for his land and pity his people. Sounds very much like the title of a booklet published some time ago, The Time to Favor Zion is Come, which time was spoken of not only by Joel, but repeatedly in the Psalms and the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah, among others. In verse 19, the return of God's favor to the land of Israel is further described as an abundance of crops, which has been the case ever since Israeli agriculture and irrigation technology began to make even the desert regions of the Middle East blossom as the rose. Also the words, and I will no more make you a reproach among the heathen, speak of a time when the anti-Semitism that still pervades many nations today will end with, as Zechariah tells it in Zechariah 8:23, the Gentiles taking hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will come with you, for God is with you. Verse 20 describes an army which attacks Israel from the north, but is driven away, sounding much like Ezekiel 38, particularly verse 15, which describes a mighty army out of the north parts. Here Joel foretells the successful defense of Israel as God drives this attacking army away. Verses 21 through 27 continue Joel's description of all the wonders God performs on literal natural Israel's behalf when his favor returned in 1878 and onward. And we have seen much of these blessings and favors in our day, in agriculture, in politics, and in technology, to name a few. I don't have time to touch on all the details that we could use to interpret the specifics in these verses, because I want to move ahead now to the second application of these verses that we read, namely to symbolic Israel, the true church, in the harvest of the gospel age and on into the kingdom. Returning back to verses 18 to 20, for our second look at these verses and how they apply to the true church, God now speaks to his people now the church class, and says, I will send you corn, wine, and oil. Corn meal, or meat, as it is described in the scriptures and as we explained in part one, is a reference, we think, to the meat in due season given to the true church in the harvest of the gospel age by the seventh messenger. Wine is a symbol of doctrine, either true or false, and in this case it is the true doctrines of the ransom and the two salvations and more brought to light by Brother Russell, through whom the oil, which has always pictured God's Holy Spirit, worked mightily. And as verse 19 continues, we, the true church class, are satisfied therewith. The Hebrew word translated satisfied is also translated to the full, which signifies, I think, not only the satisfying fullness and completeness of the truth in the harvest message, but also I suggest the time frame when the church class itself is complete. The fullness of the Gentiles has come in, as Paul described it in Romans 11:25. The last phrase in verse 19 and all of verse 20 describe the ultimate triumph of the now completed church class. No longer the church militant beset by her foes, but now the church triumphant. The church glorified. She is no longer reproached by the non-believers. Her enemies are driven away and destroyed. The geographical reference in verse 20 seems to indicate the deserts of southern Judea. And isn't that a poetic, symbolic justice? In Joel 1:10 and 11, it was the true church that was driven to a symbolic wilderness wasteland by the swarm of symbolic locusts, and, as is also described in Revelation 12:6, by a symbolic great red dragon. But now, in this time frame, the tables are turned. Satan, the one who declared, I will ascend to the sides of the north in Isaiah 14:13, is now driven to isolation in the south, the opposite direction, and to eventual destruction. In verse 20, Joel says, his stink will come up, and his ill savor shall come up, because he hath done great things. That is, terrible things, because we're speaking here of that enemy, Satan. John the Revelator, in chapter 19, verse 3, describes the destruction of symbolic Babylon, one of the great evil things Satan created, and her smoke rising up forever and ever. In Revelation 20, verse 10, the devil himself is cast into the lake of fire and tormented forever and ever. Both of these pictures describe the memory of Satan and his great evil things that will guide mankind away from evil in the kingdom forever and ever. But wait, there's more. Not only is the church complete and Satan destroyed, but the curse on the earth is removed in Joel 2:21-26. This is our third application of these verses to restored mankind in the kingdom. And here are just a few details in these verses which almost explain themselves. The pastures of the wilderness spring. The trees bear their fruit. The rains will come in abundance. The floors will be full of wheat, and the people shall eat in plenty. Now, these words surely refer to the literal food that will be available in abundance for all mankind in the kingdom. But in addition, these words, I think, are describing a feeding of truth and restitution blessings given to all mankind in the kingdom. Recall the similar and familiar picture of this time in Revelation 22, of a river of water of life and trees on both sides of that river for the feeding and the healing of the nations. Verse 26 adds to this picture of the kingdom on earth and its blessing to all mankind with the words, "And my people shall never be ashamed." The Hebrew word translated ashamed also means disappointed. I like that thought. All mankind, God's people, will never be disappointed at how God hath dealt wondrously with them. They will be overjoyed at the blessings they are receiving from his hand in the kingdom. Verse 27 adds to this picture of the kingdom on earth and includes a repetition of part of verse 26. Verse 27 says, and here God is talking to the restored masses of mankind, "And ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and none else, and my people shall never be ashamed." All mankind will become Israelitish, as Brother Russell describes them. And our well-known Zechariah 8:23, which I referenced before, tells us, I'll quote it now, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." The last seven words of verse 27 are the part of verse 26 that is repeated. Now, it could be that Joel is just being repetitious for emphasis. And keep that thought in mind, because we're going to see other repetitions in Joel. But perhaps there is a difference in these two verses in who is being identified as my people. In verse 26, my people, as I said before, seems to clearly refer to mankind in the kingdom, given the context of the verse and the words preceding. And the same could be true of my people in verse 27, but I like the thought that in verse 27, God is here describing the heavenly phase of the kingdom, in contrast with the earthly phase of the kingdom in verse 26. And so in verse 27, God is describing his peculiar people, spiritual Israel. And Peter describes us in 1 Peter 2:9 as God's peculiar people. And also Paul in Titus 2:14 says, we are his peculiar people, with whom God dwells in our midst when the completed church is glorified. And they, we, too, the glorified saints, will never be ashamed or disappointed at the part we are privileged to play in God's grand plan of the ages. What an inspiring vision. Well, I almost wish the book of Joel ended right here at Joel 2:27. The church is complete. Satan is destroyed. The ages to come have begun, and Israel and mankind are restored and blessed forevermore. So what else is there to talk about? Why is there still another chapter and several verses in the book of Joel? Well, there's plenty to talk about, as it turns out. Not further along in time after the verses we just considered, because that has taken us to the ages to come. I think beginning with Joel 2:28, the prophet is given another view of things he has already seen before, of times and events that he has already spoken about. But in this second view, Joel is given more details of his vision of natural Israel restored, her enemies destroyed, and the establishment of the kingdom. And this repeated look at the same prophetic events in more detail and from different perspectives, a repeated view and a repeated view, is not unique in Joel. The book of Revelation, for one example, which we've already seen, has some similarities to Joel's prophecy, also has repeated looks at the gospel age time periods from different perspectives, cities, trumpets, seals on a scroll, and plagues, to name just a few. Repeated looks at the same events, but from a different perspective and with different symbols. Okay, back to Joel now. It seems to me that the last five verses of chapter 2 should really be the first five verses of chapter 3, reporting Joel's new look at the same time and events as he has previously discussed. Let's look at Joel 2:28 to 32. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness, and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord hath said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. If my interpretations thus far are correct, and I eagerly await your feedback at the end of this discourse, then these verses, and continuing into chapter 3, are a rewind back in time to the gospel age and its harvest, particularly events which bring about the destruction of the old world order. The first piece of evidence supporting this suggestion is the word afterward in verse 28, which tells us that the fulfillment of verse 28 cannot chronologically follow the fulfillment of verse 27, because verse 27 has brought us to the end of the kingdom and the beginning of the ages to come. Therefore, verse 28 and the verses following must be talking about afterward in earlier time periods. And indeed, in volume 3, and in several reprint articles, Brother Russell suggests that verses 28 and 29 should be reversed chronologically, and we agree. Verse 29 continues the description of God's returned favor to natural Israel, the Jewish people, and their restoration as a nation. Afterward, after that work of blessing Israel is complete, then verse 28 is fulfilled when God's blessings are poured out on the rest of the world, the Gentile nations. As the Apostle Paul said in Romans 1:16, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." Verse 30 describes great destruction, which Brother Russell in reprint 53:17 and 18 suggests may be both symbolic and literal. He says, "We have no positive knowledge that this language is symbolic. It may refer to social upheaval and combustion, political troubles, financial troubles, and also some great physical manifestations of divine power in connection with the time of trouble." In verse 31, The sun is symbolic of the gospel light of truth concerning our Lord Jesus and his ransom sacrifice, which was hidden throughout the gospel age. The moon refers to the Mosaic law and its standards of righteous conduct, which similarly have dimmed in the immoral conduct of the world, with evil waxing worse and worse in our own days and present time. Verse 32 once again skips forward to the kingdom after all the destruction of the old order is complete with the comforting words, "Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance," a fitting description of the restitution work. And those words should suggest to your mind Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 to 4. We'll talk about one of them later. That brings us to the continuation of these prophetic pronouncements in the final chapter of the book, Joel chapter 3. Once again, we're going to see the same pattern I mentioned last time, that even within this overall good news of the second part of the book of Joel, there is bad news and then followed again by good news. I'll read the bad news on Israel's enemies, which I guess maybe is actually good news for Israel, in Joel 3, 1 to 16. "For behold, in those days and in that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem," and bring again here means don't give them another captivity, but it means to bring the captives back home again. "I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And they have cast lots for my people and have given a boy for an harlot and sold a girl for wine that they might drink. Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon and all the coasts of Palestine? Will ye render me a recompense? And if ye recompense me, swiftly and speedily will I return your recompense upon your own head. Because ye have taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my goodly pleasant things. The children also of Judah and the children of Jerusalem may be sold unto the Grecians, that ye might remove them far from their border. Behold, I will raise them out of the place whither ye have sold them and will return your recompense upon your own head. And I will sell your sons and your daughters into the land, into the hand of the children of Judah, and they shall sell them to the Sabaeans, to a people far off, for the Lord hath spoken it. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, 'I am strong.' Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. The Lord shall also roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. But the Lord will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel." Going back now to verse 1, the time marker is interesting. It's a double time marker, so we don't miss the fact that Joel is, again, taking another look, rewinding to events which precede what he talked about in chapter 2, those events which brought us all the way to the ages to come. Now Joel rewinds time to the final destruction of this present evil world with some detail he did not provide in chapter 2. The double time marker is the two-part phrase, "in those days and in that time." What days? What time? When I bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, this is the restoration of the nation of Israel, the people, and the land. In what year, what days, what time was that? 1878, when Israel's double of 1845 years, which began in AD 33, with our Lord's pronouncement, your house is left unto you desolate, was complete. The time to favor Zion had come, and I need not remind you of all the miraculous events that have taken place in Israel over the last 144 years. Verse 2 gives us the place where Jehovah gathers all the Gentile nations to destroy them, the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Well, where is the Valley of Jehoshaphat? First of all, there was a king with that strange name, Jehoshaphat, a king of the two-tribe kingdom of Judah, sometime after the 10 tribes had broken away and were called the kingdom of Israel. And his name, Jehoshaphat, means judged of Jehovah, a fitting description given the next few words of verse 2. I will plead with them, the Gentile nations, for my people and my heritage, Israel, whom I have scattered among you. Now that word plead in the original Hebrew does not mean what you might think of the way we use that word plead today. Today when someone pleads, it is a weaker person begging a stronger person for mercy or for a favor. Please. God does not plead with the Gentile nations in that sense of the word. He renders his judgment upon them, recall the meaning of the name Jehoshaphat, and then God destroys the Gentile nations. But once again, where is this Valley of Jehoshaphat, if there is a literal place with that name, where this indictment of the Gentile nations for their mistreatment of the Jewish people takes place? The location is not given in the Bible. In fact, the phrase Valley of Jehoshaphat does not appear anywhere outside the book of Joel in the Old Testament. Now, Bible scholars suggest that the Valley of Jehoshaphat is the same as the Kidron Valley on the east side of the Temple Mount, which runs between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives. If you follow the Kidron Valley away from Jerusalem, do you know where it ends? In the Dead Sea. A fitting picture of the destruction of the old world order after the nations have been judged of Jehovah and come to the end of the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Verses 3-8 in Joel 3 continue this declaration of the indictment of the Gentile nations with some prophetic detail, perhaps depicting the horrible mistreatment of Jews at the hands of the Gentile nations, particularly in the Dark Ages, and also during the Russian pogroms and the Nazi Holocaust. Verses 9-12 portray a gathering of the mighty Gentile nations for a war they will definitely lose. Here the location, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, is plainly explained as the place where God sits in judgment of the heathen. Once again, these words of Joel echo the words of other prophets who foretell the judgment and destruction of the old world order. Or should I say, those other prophets echo Joel, who perhaps wrote his prophecy before the others. See Zephaniah 1:15 as an example. Now, one particular similarity to Joel's words in these verses that no doubt caught your eye and crossed your mind is to Revelation 16:16, And he gathered them together into a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. And also verse 10, no doubt, caught your eye, because it is in the reverse of the order given to us in our well-known Isaiah 2:4. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. The fulfillment of Joel 3:10 must obviously precede the fulfillment of Isaiah 2:4. And I believe we have seen the modern equivalent of beating plowshares into swords and spears into pruning hooks, pruning hooks into spears, ever since World War I, when nations diverted their energy and resources away from agriculture and commerce to the manufacture of guns, bombs, and nuclear weapons. But it was always nations and their large armies that faced off against each other, the strong against the strong. Until, relatively recently, when the weak said, "I am strong," when individual terrorists strapped bombs to their chests and murdered dozens, even hundreds, and when armed groups, small in number but well-equipped in the latest weapons technology, carried out terrorist attacks in highly visible and well-publicized manners for maximum effect. Verse 13 of Joel 3 seems to describe the harvest and destruction of the vine of the earth, the nominal church systems, as they are described in a similar prophecy in Revelation chapter 14, verses 19 to 20. In Joel 3:14, the word decision means a threshing instrument in the Hebrew. Listen to the articles of indictment in this decision against the nominal church systems. In verse 15, the nominal church systems darkened with their false doctrines and erroneous teachings the true meaning of the Son, the gospel message of the New Testament, as well as the true meaning of all the types and shadows and prophecies in the Old Testament. The stars of heaven, the saints of God, were oppressed into virtual silence. But now their judgment and the time of their destruction has come. The words of verse 16 say, "The heavens and the earth shall shake." And these words call to mind Haggai 2, 6, and 7. Once again, so many prophets seem to repeat the themes and the details of Joel. "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations, the kingdom, shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts." There are so many details in these verses that we could discuss and point to fulfillments in times past and soon to come, but our time is almost up. So let's move on to the final verses of our lesson today, the good news in the final verses of the book of Joel, Joel 3, 17 to 21. "So shall ye know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall no strangers pass through her any more. And it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drop down new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the rivers of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth of the house of the Lord, and shall water the valley of Shittim. Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom shall be a desolate wilderness, for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall dwell forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. For I will cleanse their blood that I have not cleansed, for the Lord dwelleth in Zion." Verses 17 and 18 are a poetic picture of the kingdom with wording that calls to mind other prophecies of the kingdom and the book of Revelation. Examples include Isaiah 11:9 and 65:25, where it says, They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. In Revelation 22, verses 1 and 2, which describe a river of the water of life for the healing of the people, proceeding out from the throne of God in the New Jerusalem, the kingdom. Verses 19 to 21 again describe literal Israel's place of honor in the kingdom, as we saw in Joel 2, 27 and 28. Here in Joel 3, 19 to 21, literal Israel's literal enemies, Egypt and Edom, are no more, for all mankind has become Israelitish, as I mentioned before. And I think there is also a metaphorical or symbolic reference to the old world order of this present evil world in these final verses of Joel. Egypt perhaps represents the secular systems of the old world order, nations and governments and kings and presidents. Edom perhaps represents the religious systems of this present evil world, churches and priests and false doctrines and rituals. And it seems to me that these final verses of Joel's prophecy suggest, in poetic terms, all mankind in the kingdom taking a final look back in their memories one last time at their previous lives in this present evil world and seeing nothing. Desolate wildernesses where the old order once stood so prominently in their lives and in their misery. Nothing worth dwelling upon or even missing in that past evil world, for the former things have passed away. But Judah shall dwell forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. For I will cleanse their blood that I have not cleansed, for the Lord dwelleth in Zion. Thus will it be when the restitution work is complete. What a vision. So ends the prophecy of Joel, and may the Lord add his blessing.